This is the tax update for May the 9th, 2008. This week, all IRS employees are not equal, at least when you try to file. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and supporting document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio file. Such prohibited use include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Now, we've had a couple of discussions in the past recently here about issues with taxpayers who filed their return via the United States Postal Service. However, there is another way to file the return, and this week we look at the story of a taxpayer who found out that when you are hand-filing a return at the IRS office, the way you do it can become very important to establishing your date of filing, and some of the importance may be in steps that are not going to be immediately obvious to the taxpayer. The ruling we are looking at came down from the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in the case of Allnut Sr. v. Commissioner, 2008-1 USTC, paragraph 50,310. The matter became important because the date that Mr. Allnut filed his returns would determine whether or not the IRS's assessments had been issued after the statute of limitations had expired. If the date Mr. Allnut delivered the return to the district counsel's office and handed a copy to an employee in the IRS offices counted, the IRS was out of luck. But if instead Mr. Allnut was found to have failed in his task, that return didn't count as filed until later. Through means that aren't exactly clear, it made its way to the IRS service center, a later date that would make the IRS assessment timely. Now let's look at hand filing a return, because most taxpayers file the return in the mail. And we've previously gone over those issues involving the proof of filing for such returns, as well as the unsettled view in the Court of Appeals about how Section 7502 comes into play in such a case and the IRS's proposed regulations to resolve that matter, not surprisingly in the IRS's favor. But there is another way available to always file your return. You can hand carry them to the IRS. That less traveled road has its own rules. Internal Revenue Code Section 6091 generally governs the filing, and 6091B provides the following. In the case of returns of tax required under authority of Part 2 of this subchapter, for persons other than corporations, the general rule. Except as provided in subparagraph B, a return other than a corporation return shall be made to the Secretary in the Internal Revenue District in which is located the legal residence or principal place of business of the person making the return, or at a service center serving the Internal Revenue District referred to in Clause I, as the Secretary may by regulations designate. Now, the Secretary has provided us with regulations that govern that filing at the local IRS office when a taxpayer doesn't want to take the risk the return will get lost in the mail, but instead wants to hand it over to the IRS. Today, the hand-carried return regulation is found at Section 1.6091-2D, and it reads as follows. For hand-carried returns, notwithstanding paragraphs 1 and 2 of Section 6091B and paragraph C of this section, for persons other than corporations, returns of persons other than corporations which are filed by hand-carrying shall be filed with any person assigned the responsibility to receive hand-carried returns in the local IRS office as provided in paragraph A of this section. Now, when Mr. Allnut filed his return, the wording was slightly different. Though for the point of law we're going to discuss today, it doesn't really matter, but it does give us a slightly different person we were aiming for back then. At that time, Regulation 1.6091-2D1 read, persons other than corporations, returns of persons other than corporations which are filed by hand-carrying shall be filed with the district director or any person assigned administrative supervision of an area, zone, or local office constituting a permanent post of duty within the Internal Revenue District of such director, as provided in paragraph A of this section. Mr. Allnut's aim for the year in question was going to be the district director at that time, because that's what the regulation then required. But it turns out the district director's lunch schedule would end up thwarting Mr. Allnut's attempts to deliver the return to that individual, and eventually thwarting his ability to get out of this assessment by arguing the IRS had not timely issued it. Now, take a look at Mr. Allnut's facts. Mr. Allnut had a little issue. He apparently had failed to file his returns for a number of years, and that fact came to the IRS's notice, resulting in an investigation of Mr. Allnut. Mr. Allnut obtained counsel to assist him in dealing with this issue, and now that he had come to the attention of the IRS, and he hired an accounting firm to prepare his returns for 1981 through 1995. He'd put off filing for a little while. His attorney was, not surprisingly, in contact with the Department of Justice. His counsel informed Mr. Allnut to file his returns by hand with the district counsel's office in Baltimore, where Mr. Allnut lived. The court doesn't say so, but it seems likely, given the number of years in question, that his counsel was at the time probably more concerned with avoiding a criminal action against Mr. Allnut than necessarily dealing with the civil tax matters of the 15 years of unpaid income taxes. However, in a footnote, the Court of Appeals does take a verbal swipe at the advice given, noting, as Allnut later realized, this advice was ill-given. The district counsel's office is part of the IRS's legal department, which, with the help of the United States Justice Department, represents the IRS in certain court proceedings. It does not have the authority to accept tax returns for filing. In 1997, a Baltimore, Maryland resident, such as Allnut, wishing to file his federal income tax returns by hand, was required to deliver the returns to the district director's office in Baltimore, not the district counsel's office. The district director's office, now defunct, was responsible for the administration of all IRS operations within a given tax district. But, as we will see, delivery of the returns to district counsel's office wasn't going to be the issue, at least as far as the Court of Appeals appeared to be concerned, though at the time Mr. Allnut believed that delivery was the filing of his returns, and that distinction was important to the tax court. The Court of Appeals doesn't really tell us it's not important, but the Court of Appeals says, regardless of whether it is or isn't, there are other problems. However, it appears Mr. Allnut almost got lucky. He decided he would, as a courtesy, provide a copy of the returns to the IRS district director. These copies were signed again by Mr. Allnut in blue ink. Both copies of the return were accompanied by a letter that stated, "Dear Mr. Harrington and Mrs. Henn, I am delivering to district counsel with this letter original filings of 1040 tax returns for the tax year 1981 and for each year here thereafter up through and including 1995. My attorney has spoken with the Department of Justice individual who has instructed him to have me file said returns with district counsel." Now, Paul Harrington was the IRS district director for the Baltimore area, while Elizabeth Henn was the IRS district counsel for that same area. Had he actually gotten that courtesy copy to Mr. Harrington, Mr. Allnut would probably have succeeded in filing his returns as the regulations prescribed on February 21, 1997, presuming that the Court of Appeals would have held at that point that it didn't matter. He might have thought he was filing it somewhere else earlier. He actually ended up filing it properly with the district director. Now, the date is established for the return that was delivered to the district counsel's office. Now, remember, that's the one that doesn't count. Has her secretary stamped the transmittal letter received 2/21/97 and signed her name under the stamp. And Mr. Allnut got the copy of that transmittal letter and took that with him to prove that he had filed it. Those returns eventually made their way to the special procedures office of the Baltimore District on March 10th of 1997. Those returns were never processed by the IRS, but they did make it to that office date on March 10th. As we'll discover in the IRS internal files, that March 10th date became the date the IRS felt they had to issue the assessment by. After making that delivery, Mr. Allnut took copies of the return and transmittal over to the IRS office building where the district director's office was located. He placed those returns in an envelope marked solely "Attention, Mr. Paul Harrington," intending them to deliver them to Mr. Harrington so he was aware that he had filed those returns in question, though he testified he did so more as a courtesy than as a filing. The envelope did not indicate that tax returns were inside the envelope. These returns had all the information of the ones he intended to file, and he clearly signed them. So it appears very possible that, and with the footnote reference the court gives us on this matter, that the Court of Appeals might have said, "Okay, we know you didn't think you were filing them then, but, you know, you really kind of did so we could accept that." So if we believe that's how it would have come out, He may have been extremely close through simple dumb luck in accomplishing the goal needed to file the returns on February 21st, 1997. However, events would conspire to snatch defeat out of the jaws of victory for Mr. Allnut. Wanting to make delivery to Mr. Harrington, who Mr. Allnut believed is who should see the fact that he had filed these copies of the return, he took the obvious first step of asking directions to the district director's office when he came inside the IRS building. He asked a security guard for directions to Mr. Harrington's office, though he didn't tell the guard why he wanted to see Mr. Harrington. He also did not consult with the IRS employees working at the Taxpayer Services walk-in area on the first floor of the building, which is normally the first place taxpayers go when they're trying to hand-file a tax return. But again, Mr. Allnut didn't believe he was filing a tax return. The security guard informed Mr. Allnut that Mr. Harrington was at lunch, but he might go see a different individual whose name he provided him. Unfortunately, Mr. Allnut didn't make a record of who this person was, nor did he recall that person's name or title. However, he did go in search of that person at the IRS's office. His odyssey in the IRS offices continued, and he found the person in a hallway on a different floor than the office of the district director. Now, that person, as we said, not being located on that floor and also being referred to as a gentleman, suggests that one thing we do know for sure is that person was not Mrs. Harrington, was not Mr. Harrington's secretary. The gentleman that Mr. Allnut did find again informed him that the district director was at lunch, and he offered to take the package and give it to the district director when he got back from lunch. Mr. Allnut specifically asked this individual if he had the authority to accept packages on behalf of Mr. Harrington, and he responded that he did. Again, still not telling him what's in the package, he just asked him did he have the authority to accept one. Now, Mr. Allnut gave him the package and asked if he would be sure to give the package to Mr. Harrington personally, a request to which the unknown IRS employee agreed. Now, Mr. Allnut did not ask for a date stamp at this office, unlike what he did at the district counsel's office, believing the stamp from the district counsel's office confirmed the filing date because he, per his attorney's advice, believed that delivering the return to the district counsel's office was the filing of the return. We do know that at some point the IRS received that package with the copies of the return, because copies of that return would eventually be processed as tax returns by the IRS. But the route they took to get to the service center is not very clear, and based on the IRS records of this mystery envelope and its journey through the system. We do know that sometime between February 21st and May 9th, 1997, the returns were forwarded to the IRS Philadelphia Service Center. The Court of Appeals notes that, quoting from their opinion, on the front page of each return appears, 1, IRS received from District 052197, 2, postmark 050997 and received 051497, number 3, delinquent original cleared for processing by 285 on June 16, 1997, and 4, resort received on June 27, 1997. On the bottom left corner of the front page of each return, POS sorted for statute review 51497 also appears, but is struck out in an attempt to make it indistinguishable. On a date not specified in the record, an identified IRS employee also added a document located number to the upper right corner of the first page of each photocopied return. The government admits that these returns, rather than the originals delivered to the district counsel's office, were those processed by the IRS. However, what we don't have is any record that Mr. Harrington received those returns on February 21, 1997. His secretary, Susan Arzinski, testified that typically she processed all deliveries to the district director, and if someone from the IRS had brought a package in for Mr. Harrington, it would have been delivered to her. She testified that, quoting from the court decision, her usual practice was to stamp an item with the time and date that she received it, and to use Harrington's routing stamp on the item if there was any room to do so. If there was no room on the document, she would ordinarily staple to the item a small routing slip containing the same information as a routing stamp. According to Arzinski, she always used a routing stamp if the item was an income tax return. She also testified that personnel district director's offices usually directed taxpayers who wanted to file tax return to the walk-in area of the taxpayer services office located on the entry level or first floor. Unfortunately, Mr. Allnut never mentioned to anyone in the IRS that what was in that envelope were his delinquent income tax returns. What we do know is that Ms. Arzinski did not recall receiving this package on February 21st, and that none of the markings nor a routing slip attached to the return were from her. Let's go on now down the line to the ultimate assessment in 2000. The IRS issued a notice of deficiency for 1987 to 1990 and 1992 to 1995 on March 20th, 2000, which would be outside the three-year statute under 6501 for issuing that assessment if, in fact, February 21st, 1997 were the date Mr. Allnut filed his returns. However, if we rather looked at the May dates or the March date that it got to the district office from the chief counsel's office or general counsel's office, then the assessment was timely and Mr. Allnut would lose on the issue. The IRS file for Mr. Allnut seemed to bolster his case. I should say not March 20th. We're going to look at a different date in March for that assessment. The Court of Appeals notes that the IRS employees are charged with tracking the expiration dates of the statute, and the employee initially responsible for the Allnut's file recorded the date received as February 20th. That date was based on the date Mr. Allnut signed the return, a procedure given by the Internal Revenue Manual to be used by IRS employees in cases where no postmark is available. And in this case, there was no such information. Of course, from the IRS perspective, this is a protective move. The taxpayer has basically conceded that as of the date they signed the return, they, you know, had basically had the return. That is the earliest possible filing date that the taxpayer can attempt to argue at this point that they made, at least absent some other evidence that that date's just an error. So the IRS position is that's a concession that so long as we get it done within 3 years of that date, we're within the statute. That date, however, would be revised. On February 20th of 2000, the date was changed to March 10th, 2000, which was 3 years from the date the original return was received by the Special Procedures Office in Baltimore. Now let's look at the Court of Appeals ruling. The Court of Appeals was hearing an appeal from an initial ruling on this matter from the United States Tax Court. The Court of Appeals summarized the tax court ruling as follows. The tax court ultimately found the following. Allnut was a credible witness and did deliver the photocopied returns with original signature to someone in the building containing the district director's office on February 21, 1997. Allnut did not, however, file those photocopies returned on that date because he did not honestly and reasonably intend those returns to be his filed returns. And, per the tax court, a taxpayer may not, by his or her ambiguous conduct, even if unintentional, secure the benefit of the limitations period. And three, Allnut's returns were filed on March 10, 1997, when the Special Procedures Office of the Baltimore District Director stamped them received. Therefore, the court held that the notice of deficiency sent by the IRS on March 6, 2000 was properly issued within the three-year limitation period beginning on March 10, 1997, the date that Allnut's return were deemed filed. After the tax court issued its final decision on other issues in Allnut's case not applicable here, Allnut filed a timely appeal. The Court of Appeals outlined its view of what had to be shown for Mr. Allnut to prevail in this case. It is well established that a statute of limitation runs against the United States only when it assents and upon the conditions prescribed. Statutes of limitation sought to be applied to bar rights of the government, therefore, must receive a strict construction in favor of the government. Thus, a taxpayer seeking to secure the benefit of the limitation must demonstrate meticulous compliance with all named conditions and applicable requirements of the Code and Treasury regulations. And the court continues. Thus, to prevail here, Allnut must first demonstrate that he meticulously complied with the codes and regulations requirement that he or his agent deliver his hand-carried returns to the Baltimore District Director or Administrative Supervisor, not to some other individual, regardless of his or her proximity to the prescribed person. To avail himself of the protections of the statute of limitation, Allnut must further show that he filed the returns in such a manner on or before March 6, 1997. Now the court outlines the problems that will prevent Mr. Allnut from showing that meticulous compliance required with the code and regulations. First, the court notes that Mr. Allnut admits the delivery of the returns to district counsel's office did not constitute a filing under the regulation. Unfortunately, that was the one thing he could document had happened. He had a dated, signed, confirmed slip. Everybody agreed the district counsel's office got returns on February the 21st. The court found a number of problems with his delivery to the district director's office that removed any chance of finding meticulous compliance with the delivery requirements. First, The photocopies were never delivered directly to the district director, his assistant, or even his office. Second, he did not take the photocopy returns to the taxpayer services area of the office where hand-filed returns are normally handled. And three, since he was under the mistaken assumption that delivery had that the delivery to the district council's office had constituted filing of the return, he left a sealed envelope containing the returns with an unidentified man of unknown title, did not obtain a receipt, and simply hoped the gentleman would keep his word and deliver the package to District Director Harrington. But what about that internal document that showed the date of February 20th, 2000 for expiration of the statute that only got changed at the last minute on February 20th, 2000 to make March 10th that date? Well, the court points out that's not going to help him in this case. First, as Allnut admits in his evidence from the dates inscribed on the form, Blum, the IRS agent initially responsible for Allnut's file, ascertained the February 20th received an expiration date based upon Allnut's self-declared date of signature on his return, not from any other evidence that Allnut delivered the returns directly to the district director at that time. As an aside, I'd note, we know by his own testimony that he agreed he delivered those returns on February 21st, the day later than the date that was in the file. But continuing, in fact, as Allnut also admits, Blum used this date specifically because there was no other date including indicating when his return had been filed. Furthermore, although statute of limitation date on IRS internal documentation may be used as evidence of the appropriate filing date, contrary to Allnut's intimation, the IRS is not bound by their own internal documents or self-imposed due dates. Here, the IRS noticed the supposed error and changed the filing date to March 10, 1997. The only verified date available indicating when Allnut's returns, original or photocopied, were actually received by an office affiliated with the Baltimore District Director. Allnut provides no documentation demonstrating with any degree of certainty that his returns were filed prior to this date. Now, as an interesting aside, and it's probably more because the IRS conceded that that was the date because they didn't need to worry about it, it did not ever really show that we had actually complied with the requirement of getting it to the district director for a hand-carried return. All we demonstrated was that eventually it got inside the district director's office, the office where the district director was, and because of that, the IRS conceded and used that as the date. We don't know if, in fact, the assessment had been issued after March 10th, if the IRS would have succeeded in claiming that, in fact, the filing date was even later than that date. But they didn't need to argue that, and the court didn't need to decide it. Now, the court indicates it can't help but be sympathetic to Mr. Allnut's situation and also notes that it cannot help but observe that the IRS could have obviated the problem. How's that? I can pronounce that eventually. Here, by proceeding more expeditiously. However, the court notes that they are bound to strictly construe a statute of limitations, and due to that, they have to conclude the assessments were not issued after the statute had expired, but rather were issued timely. The catch in this case, if you have a taxpayer that does want to file returns by hand, it is important that they file them in accordance with the current regulations. Notice the district director is not the current way you get it done. It's also important to note that we still have some of the same problems there. Once a taxpayer lets go of it in a fashion that's not protected, we have a difficult time establishing the dates of filing and proving our items for the statute of limitations. If you do have a taxpayer that wants to hand deliver, be sure you go back over the regulations with the taxpayer to make sure the taxpayer properly takes it in and properly handles it. As well, it's important not to give very brief or easy advice. Note, the attorney in this case gave Mr. Allnut advice that now the Court of Appeals has said was apparently wasn't quite right. That's probably not a good position for the attorney to be in should Mr. Allnut decide that he wants to try to recover some of his shortfall from that direction. Again, make sure that you communicate carefully and preferably in writing to your client about how to handle these matters. Now, I've been involved this week. I was out actually speaking to the California Society of CPAs tax and estate planning committees. They had a little meeting this week that I was speaking at. I'm preparing for my presentation in Arizona that's going to come up in June. I've got a couple of presentations in June. First, at the Financial Planning Conference for the Arizona Society of CPAs. I'm going to be doing a session there about who's trying to get in your computer and how they're trying to get in computer security. I then come back the next week and we do the full one-day session, the full regular CPE session on tax practice, ethics, and standards. That, again, is an 8-hour course. Does qualify for the 4-hour Arizona ethics requirement. So if you're looking to get your ethics and still want to, and also would like to take a full day course, well, that's a way to get it done here. And getting ready for a couple of other presentations coming up. In July, I will be doing a presentation for the Arizona Society on the use of virtual machines. You may find that on their website to run, actually to run concurrently Windows XP and Windows Vista. And I've got a few other courses obviously coming up down the line on various items. Later this year, I will be in California doing S-Corps and partnerships, bouncing around in Sacramento, San Francisco, and in Los Angeles and Pasadena, as I believe my 4 cities, 5 days, interesting trip coming up. And I'm going to be doing a few other courses as times go on, but hopefully we'll be able to keep the podcast up to speed and be able to keep giving you these things on a regular basis. Now, this has been the Tax Update Podcast for May the 9th, 2008. The Tax Update Podcast, as always, is brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Be sure to consider subscribing to their services. This has been the Tax Update.